There's almost a sense of annual pilgrimage as we come together each year on this Good Friday for this convention. And today I'd like to look at some pilgrim psalms, Psalms 120 to 134. These were psalms which, I believe, pilgrims sang as they came from some of the country areas of Palestine up to Jerusalem for the annual festivals. They may have sung these as they went up for the annual Passover festival, and today, of course, is Passover Day. But I don't want to push that sort of parallel too far. What I want to do is to go through these 15 psalms and see if we can trace the movement of these pilgrims as they moved from their country regions up to worship God at the temple in Jerusalem. In my Bible, which is the RSV, these psalms are called songs of ascents, songs that they sang as they ascended to Jerusalem. In the King James Version, they are called songs of degrees. So if you want to use that word, I suppose you could say they were songs that they sang as they moved along stage by stage on their journey. We start in Psalm 120 with the people in some remote village of Palestine where they are largely among non-Jewish people. Around Jerusalem, of course, the population was mainly Jewish. In the country areas, there were many non-Jewish people. And the person who compiles this psalm shows how they're looking for relief from some of the persecution that they receive from their unfriendly neighbours. Incidentally, these psalms were not necessarily written for the purpose of singing on the journey to Jerusalem. The psalms were written by various people, but they were collected, I believe, and arranged in this order because that's the way they were used. Some of the psalms you'll find were by David. There's one that was by Solomon. But the people took these psalms, no matter who they were composed by, and worked them into this sequence. Just the same as we in our service today have had hymns that were written by different people in different circumstances for different purposes, but they have been arranged into a sequence to fit the theme of our meeting today. Well, that appears to be what has happened here. Existing psalms have been put into this sequence to suit this particular purpose. And so the psalmist starts at 120 by saying that in his distress he cries to the Lord and he says, "Oh, deliver me, my God," in verse 2, "deliver me from lying lips and a deceitful tongue." Which doesn't mean stop me from being a liar and stop me from deceiving people in my speech. What he means is deliver me from the deceitful speech, from the lying tongues of others. Deliver me from the venom which some of these people have as they persecute me. He says, "I've had enough of living in these far-off places among these unsympathetic people. Woe is me," verse 5. He says, "I feel as if I sojourn in Meshech, as if I dwell among the tents of Kedar. I feel as if I'm living in a far-off land where I'm surrounded by hostile Arabs." And as we know, Jews were never terribly popular when they lived among the Arabs. And so now he decides he'll seek some peace, some refuge in the house of God. "Too long have I had my dwelling among those who hate peace," he says. And so now I'm going to move up to Jerusalem and there worship God. So in Psalm 121 they move off. He lifts up his eyes to the hills in the opening verse. And he says, "From whence comes my help? It comes from the Lord who made the heaven and the earth. This great creation I'm walking through, the Lord of this creation protects me," he says. Verse 3, "He will not let my foot be moved." He doesn't slumber or sleep. "He protects me," he says, "as I move along the journey. I can sleep by the roadside at night. I can go during the day without fear of bandits and robbers because I know that God is protecting me." In verse 6, "By day or by night," he says, "I have this hand of God upon me." And in verse 8, he knows that the Lord will keep him. He says, "The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in." That is, he will protect you and take you to Jerusalem, and he will bring you back home again. And so in this confidence now, the pilgrims move along their journey. Psalm 122 seems that they now can almost picture themselves standing in the temple in the opening couple of verses. He says in the opening verse, I was glad when they said, let's go to the house of the Lord. And so now he says, here we are on our way to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. And in verse 2, the pilgrims can picture themselves standing now there in the temple. And the excitement grips them as they think of what's ahead. It reminds me of when we were children and we were going for our annual holiday to the beach, and we used to get very excited. We'd talk about what we were going to do, and we'd talk about the trees that we had climbed and the places we had been and what we were going to do next time. Well, this is the sort of excitement that grabs these people. Once again, the annual pilgrimage up to Jerusalem, and now with great excitement and anticipation, they picture their dreams as being fulfilled as they stand there in the temple in Jerusalem. They see Jerusalem in verse 3 as a city that is strong and firmly bound together, to which the tribes of Israel go up in verse 4. All the tribes from their different country areas, from the remote parts, from the north in Galilee, from across the river, the eastern tribes, from the south, from the center, all over the nation, going up to Jerusalem to give thanks to the name of the Lord. This prompts them in verse 6 to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they prosper who love you. They pray not only that they'll have a great time of worship when they go there, but they pray for Jerusalem. This is the center of their nation. This is where the temple is built. And they pray that God might preserve its peace. Peace be within your walls. Verse 8, for my brethren and companions' sake, I will say, peace be within you. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good. Here are people who are concerned for the ongoing prosperity of their nation and for the health of their collective worship. And so they pray for Jerusalem. They pray that it might be preserved, and that their temple might be preserved, so that they can go up year by year and offer this collective worship to God. So they move on then to the next psalm. And here, once again, we see reflected something of the hostility which some of these pilgrims met as they were going along the road. People who persecuted them, who mocked them because of the hardships which they put up along the way simply to go and worship in Jerusalem. Everybody else is out enjoying themselves. Why do you people go to such difficulty simply to go and worship your God? And so again they cry to God as they are beset with these temptations from people round about who are more interested in a self-indulgent lifestyle and don't have time to stop and give God the worship and praise that is due to him. And so they pray to God in verse 3 to have mercy on us, O Lord. Have mercy on us, for we've had more than enough of contempt, and sometimes we get a bit sick of it, the way these people throw off at us because of our faith in God. Too long, verse 4, too long our soul has been sated with the scorn of those who are at ease, the contempt of the proud. People who have no other thought than looking after themselves and enjoying life, and so they mock those who are prepared to make a sacrifice for the sake of the Lord their God, prepared to go and worship him. This theme of perseverance through persecution continues in the following psalm, 124, which you notice is a psalm of David, reflecting some of the experiences of David, who of course was very often persecuted. Well, here they can enter into the confidence of David in verse 2 and say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side when men rose up against us, they would have swallowed us up alive when their anger was kindled against us. We would have been finished, we would have been overthrown, but for the fact that God has preserved us. And he goes on to speak of something of the violence and the destruction which comes from those who oppose God. They attack God's people like wild animals. They are as cunning as hunters or bird trappers, and yet all the time God delivers his people from these dangers that they face. That's the drift of the rest of the psalm. Verse 7, for example, we have escaped as a bird from the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken and we've escaped. And so in spite of all these tricks which people have, all the opposition, all the difficulties we run into, they say we are confident that God will protect our going out and our coming in. He's going to take us safely there. He's going to give us a great time of worship, and he's going to bring us safely home again. And so we move on. We come now to Psalm 125. I have to get through 15 psalms here in 30 minutes, so we're moving at a reasonable rate. But if we can just capture the flavour of these psalms and see what the overall thrust of them is, I feel sure that it can be of great benefit to our own souls. Now, from Psalm 125 to Psalm 129, we have here a reflection which the people make as they think of Jerusalem's experiences. Some of the lessons which God's people have learnt, and I believe as we look at some of these psalms and look at the lessons which God's people in Jerusalem learnt, perhaps there are a few lessons there that we can learn. So that's the next four or five psalms. Now the believer is like Jerusalem in a sense, strong and stable. That's the confident note that Psalm 125 starts with. Those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved but abides forever. As the mountains are round about Jerusalem, so the Lord is round about his people from this time forth and forevermore. Great confidence there in Psalm 125. Psalm 126. On one occasion, God saved Jerusalem from plunderers who threatened to destroy it. Well, I suppose that happened on many occasions, but there's one particular occasion which caused the writing of this psalm, Psalm 126. And as the travelling pilgrims think of that great deliverance, the memory of it is indeed a pleasant dream. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Our mouth was filled with laughter, our tongue with shouts of joy. And they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. God has saved Jerusalem. And as we think back on that, how it gives us great heart. However, even though the place may have been delivered from the plunderers, there is still much work to be done if the place is to be rebuilt. The plundering armies come in and they trample all over the fields and they ruin the crops. And although the nation has been saved, there's a lot of damage now which has to be undone. And so the people have to go out and start working in the fields again, restoring what the invaders have ruined. Verse 5, may those who sow in tears reap with shouts of joy. Yes, they say there's hard work, and it reduces them to tears as they look at their farms, which have been minced to pieces by the invading army. But they have this confidence that those who go forth weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, one day are going to come home with shouts of joy, and they're going to bring their sheaves with them. Now there's a lesson for the travellers, there's a lesson for us. We have to persevere if we want to enjoy God's blessings. Things are not served up to us on a plate. We live in a damaged world. There are the things which are destroyed and which are ruined, and we have to so often fight against these things. We have to make fresh starts. But there is the confidence, there is the encouragement for the travellers who are going to Jerusalem in spite of all the difficulties along the way. And there is the encouragement for us also. Persevere. There must be perseverance if God's blessings are to be enjoyed. Psalm 127, we notice, is from Solomon, where he says in the opening verse that unless the Lord builds a house, those who build it labour in vain. The reference there being to the building of a family. Unless God is building the family and seeing that development in the strength and life of the family, then unless God is working in it, it's going to be in vain. Likewise in the governing of a city, in the second half of the verse, unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is God who really brings growth in the city. It is God who looks after the nation. It is God who controls the family. Whether building a family or governing a nation, God must always be at the centre. That's the message. Wise words from a wise man. What a pity that he didn't follow his own advice. Solomon was a wise governor, if perhaps a very pragmatic one. In other words, a person who was concerned only with what was expedient and wasn't particularly concerned about the principles behind it. He was a wise man, but when it came to his own family, it was something of a disaster. He gave wise teaching, but somehow he felt he didn't have to obey it himself. He was the top man in the nation. He gave wise counsel, issued wise rules for government, ones which advanced the prosperity of himself and his nation. But when it came to carrying out those principles himself, he apparently felt that he was above them. The message for us is very obvious as we look at the tragic life of Solomon and how it ended. The great kingdom which he had built up, lost. His family, total disaster. But here's the teaching for us. God must always be at the centre, whether building a family or building a nation, whether governing Jerusalem or controlling affairs in our own households. God is the one who is going to see the true prosperity developed. Psalm 128 continues the theme. Trust in God. And that brings personal satisfaction and it also brings a happy home. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. He shall eat of the fruit of the labour of his hands. Shall be happy and it shall be well with him. Verse 3, he says, your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. And so he goes on describing here the contentment which comes when God is at the centre of our personal lives and our family lives. How tragic it is at times that you have Christian families which don't know the contentment that the psalmist is talking about here. Well, they move along the road with these very healthy thoughts going through their minds. Perhaps they're approaching Jerusalem, verse 5. They're well along the journey anyway. And they say here, the Lord bless you from Zion. May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life. May you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel. So they anticipate now something of the blessings of Jerusalem as they approach. Perhaps in Psalm 129, they now have the sight of Jerusalem's walls. And these remind the travellers once again of how sorely Israel has been afflicted in the past. Surely they have afflicted me from my youth, let Israel now say. Surely they have afflicted me from my youth, yet they have not prevailed against me. It's a reference back to the days of Israel's youth. Going back to Egypt, where the people there, the nation in its infancy, and how the nation was afflicted. Well described in verse 3, the ploughs ploughed upon my back. The whiplashes of those Egyptian masters, they made long their furrows. But the Lord is righteous, and he cut the cords of the wicked. He released Israel from its captivity in Egypt, and he brought them out. Yes, they afflicted me in my youth, says Israel, but they have not prevailed. And this victory which God brought over Egypt now gives them confidence in verse 5 to say, may all who hate Zion be put to shame and turn backward. Moving on then to the next couple of psalms, they feel they must put these thoughts of retaliation, punishment and judgment out of their minds and get themselves into a better frame of mind for worship. And so their reflections on the experiences of Jerusalem and the great deliverances from the enemies, those things are now behind. And now they look forward to the worship which they are to engage in a few hours' time as they arrive in Jerusalem. So in Psalm 130 we have something of this preparation for worship. As they approach Jerusalem they can see the temple up there. And this of course is the climax of the year. They are actually to go and worship God in the temple. And because of this a great sense of the awe of the occasion overwhelms them. They are affected by a great sense of personal sin, a great sense of the greatness of God before whom they are now coming in worship. And the psalmist in verse 3 cries, if thou, O Lord, shouldst mark iniquities, Lord, who could stand? How can sinners stand before God in his holy temple? And yet, verse 4, they know that there is forgiveness with thee, O Lord, that thou mayest be feared. Just an interesting comment there, isn't it? There is forgiveness with thee that thou mayest be feared. I'm afraid with many evangelical Christians today, the attitude is, there is forgiveness with thee, therefore that's a great relief for us, and we can rather take it all for granted. Forgiveness becomes a bit too easy. The grace of God is taken for granted. This man has a better understanding of the price of forgiveness and a better appreciation of the holiness and majesty and sovereignty of God. Yes, there is forgiveness with thee. All the more reason, therefore, why we must hold God in fear and not take that forgiveness for granted. And as he has this sense of sin, in verse 5, he waits for the Lord, he waits in hope, he waits for a word of assurance that indeed there is forgiveness, and that the iniquities which he's talked about in verse 3 have indeed been forgiven. And so his soul waits for the Lord just as a watchman waits for the morning. And then in verse 7, the reassurance comes. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him there is plenteous redemption. He will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. The forgiving grace of God, this is the great assurance which the person now has. And so, aware of the forgiveness, the pilgrims now approach the temple. And as they are about to enter the temple, the awe and splendor of the occasion reduces them to a very humble position. This is a moment when they feel inadequate to express the deep feelings of their heart. O Lord, Psalm 131, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvellous for me. Doesn't mean to say that he's not to try to think on the greatness of God, but what he's saying here is, how ever can I understand the greatness of this God before whom I am now coming in worship? Here is an expression of genuine humility. He's not lazy in that he's not going to think of the greatness of God, but he has no presumption. He realizes that all his understanding of God is but a drop in the ocean compared with the greatness of God that is still there to be understood. And that's what he means. And that's the sense of the greatness of God which I'm sure must grip God's people. And when it does grip God's people, there's no doubt that it will give them a far healthier approach to worship. The greater our understanding of God, the better people we're going to be for God. If our God is too small, then everything else is going to be small. But once we can see God and have that true appreciation of the person of God, we're going to find that it affects everything there is about our lives. And so he says, I have calmed and quieted my soul, in verse 2, like a child quieted at its mother's breast. I can't understand all God's ways, he said, but I can rest assured that he is the great God, and I am content to come and to contemplate the magnificence of his person, to bring my worship and lay it before the feet of this one who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And these final three Psalms, 132 to 134, now see the pilgrims entering Israel's house of prayer. And Psalm 132 begins with a prayer that the Lord would remember all the hardships, for example, that David endured. How he swore to the Lord and vowed to the mighty one of Jacob, I will not enter my house or go into my bed, I will not give sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling place for the mighty one of Jacob. David had this great concern to build a temple for the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant had been neglected in the reign of Saul, and David was determined to bring that Ark to Jerusalem. Amid great difficulty, but also amid great rejoicing, he did finally bring that Ark to Jerusalem. His aim was to build God a house. And so the rest of this psalm goes on to speak of the experiences of the Ark of the Covenant, how it had been brought from Kiriath-Jearim, brought into Jerusalem amid great rejoicing. But verse 11 tells us that the Lord swore to David, one of the sons of your body I will set on your throne, and if your son keeps my covenant and my testimonies, which I shall teach them, then their sons also forever shall sit upon your throne. What God is saying is, I am appreciative, David, of the fact that you want to build me a house, but I have something far more important, something far better. I want to build you a house. Not a house of bricks and mortar, but a family, a dynasty, so that your sons and your sons after them will reign here in Jerusalem. The Lord has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his habitation. This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it, says the Lord, and I will abundantly bless her provisions. I will satisfy her poor with bread. And so it goes on, God giving his people all that they need. And what a tragedy it was that David, and then later Solomon, were far more concerned with building the building of bricks and mortar than they were with building the house which was their own family. And both David and Solomon had tragic family experiences. They got things around the wrong way. David wanted to build God a house, but God said, David, I've got something better. I want to build you a house. We have to be very careful that we make sure we have our priorities worked out correctly and we put the heavier emphasis where it needs to be put. Well, anyway, they come to this temple and now they are about to enter this house of prayer. Psalm 133. What a glorious sight this is to those pilgrims. They've come from different parts of the country and now they can see all the different Israelites there. Some of them from the north, some from the south, from the east, from the west. Different accents from the different regions. Different types of people. They never see each other in the normal course of events, but here they are, this once a year. The whole of the nation, as it were, is united in this act of worship in the annual festival. How good, how pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity. It's as pleasant, he goes on to say, as the perfume, that sweet-smelling oil of anointing which flowed down over the head of the high priest. It's as fresh as the dew on Mount Hermon. This beautiful picture of all God's people from all the different parts of the country coming together and offering their worship. And so they go through the day's worship. And then at the end of the day, we come to our final Psalm 134. The worshippers, as they're about to go out into the place they're staying for the night, they bid the priests and the Levites good night. The Levites changed watch as the day officials went off and the evening ones came on. And the pilgrims, in Psalm 134, verse 1, say, "Come, bless the Lord, all you servants of the Lord." Servants of the Lord, meaning the priests and Levites there, who stand by night in the house of the Lord. The night watch has just come on. And they say to these men, "Lift up your hands to the holy place and bless the Lord." "We are now going home," say the pilgrims, "and now you have come in for the night shift." And they bid these men to lift their hands up and bless the Lord. Whereupon the priests and the Levites respond, "And may the Lord bless you from Zion, he who made heaven and earth." And I think of a New Testament reference. We can take this to ourselves and perhaps apply some of the lessons, some of the teachings we've seen there today. We have come to Mount Zion. We have come to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. We have come from the far country into the Father's house. We are the chosen race, the royal priesthood, the holy nation, God's own people. And God's purpose in doing all this is that we may now declare the wonderful deeds of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light.